नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा। भूतां धम्मां संघां नमस्सामि। And I just talk about the 10 fetters. They're like 10 shackles, all that which shackles us to the wheel of samsara, to the five khandhas. Maybe also a bit. So then why I find this model quite very useful, interesting. So those 10 fetters are, in that order, a personality view or personality belief, Sakkaya-ditti in Pali. Then, which way around is it? Doesn't matter. The vichikicca, skeptical doubt in the Buddha's teaching, that would be specifically. And silabbata paramasa, a wonderful word, which means attachment to rites and rituals. Then comes sensual craving. It's the fourth one, and the fifth one is negativity or hostility. Those are different words the Buddha used from the ones that we have in the Four Noble Truths. So it's not karma tanha and vipavatana or something. It's karma raga. So that's instead of thirst for sensuality, it's craving for sensuality. But I think it's probably synonymous. And I think it's vyapada for negativity, hostility, animosity. I think we can take that for being standing in there as a force of kind of aversion to that which we don't like. So it's saying craving for what we like or aversion towards what we dislike. So those are the first five. They're sometimes also called the lower fetters, because they bind us to the comparatively lower realms. Ours belongs still to the lower realms, the human realms of existence. And then come the five higher fetters that even once you've abandoned them, they're still rupa raga and arupa raga, which is craving for fine material and craving for non-material existence. So that's for more refined realms of existence, which can be equated to really refined states of mind as well. So that's the type of experience that we can access through that. And then there are three more. I'd come to them later as we move along. So the Buddha in the suttas describes about how these fetters are given up gradually. So that's also another version of the gradual path that the Buddha was talking about. And the first stage is what the Buddha called entering the stream. Well, there's a Pali word sotapanna for that. It's entering the stream. Some of you will have heard about that. It's very much, like the jhanas. That's another one of the goodies that people are, into this Pali Buddhism crave for. Entering the stream. When am I going to enter the stream? Or maybe I have entered the stream already and I don't know about it. How do you know about it? Can somebody tell me, please, and certify? We want to go for experts to be reassured. And there we can also see again one of those inherent problems in this list, of course, though they are actually about a progressive letting go. We can use them again as something again to hold on to, precisely the first thing that we're supposed to let go on this sliding path, personality view, isn't it? Because am I the stream enter or not? That's bound up with personality view and self-image, isn't it? The so-called stream enterer, so somebody has entered the stream. It's a stream of Dhamma that the Buddha is referring there to. That's why where this word comes from. The stream of Dhamma, the stream of truth, has precisely to do with the way it's described. I remember from the suttas is having kind of the first authentic, real taste of the reality that Buddha is talking about, the Dhamma, the truth that the Buddha was teaching about, deep and clear enough to be able to let go of the first three fetters for good. There are two prerequisites that suttas actually talk about. One is this is really like more, seems to be more like something instantaneous. It's really like this experience or something that's an actual experience, which gives you this taste of truth, the taste of the Dhamma. So you have seen it. You have really seen, experienced, realized the Dhamma for really for the first time yourself, deep enough to let go of those three fetters. And it makes sense. It's personality view because you have seen through that. So you don't believe anymore that that's what you are in any substantial kind of sense, that it's a substantial kind of thing, my personality. And secondly, well, of course, if you've seen for yourself, you've got the taste, then you won't doubt that what the Buddha is talking about is actually accurate, because you've got the experience of it. You see, this is real, and it's available for me too. And then the third one, Sila Bhatta Paramasa, and at the time of the Buddha, that was also specifically intended as in opposition to more ritual kind of practices, which were strongly connected to the Vedic, Brahmanic religious practices, full of all kinds of rituals of purification. No? And so the Buddha sometimes refers to some of them even specifically, like the idea that you can wash off your sins if you bathe in a river or something like the Ganges, how do you say it in English? Ganges or Ganges River, no? Yes. And as you know, this is even these days in Hinduism, in some forms of Hinduism, this is of course still very important, held up. But actually Brahmanism and still forms of Brahmanism in present day India, which as I just recently heard again from my Indian monk friend, is full of these kinds of very precise rituals, where you go through rituals either in order to attain something or to, you know, wishes, you know, from the gods or divinities, or also for actually purifying yourself. And this is something that you do, go through particular kind of purification rituals, and that is going to get rid of some of your bad karma or things like that. No? Almost all kinds of religions, they have these kind of rituals of purity. So it's things you have to do the proper kind of way in order so that you're pure, that you can, before you can enter the temple or the mosque or the church. You know, when you go to church, you wash your hands in holy water or something when you go in. That's an example for that. No, I'm really not very familiar with those kind of things. Also, for example, in Hinduism, there's also, and that's also at the time of the Buddha, appears also in the suttas, like fire worshippers. That's also still practiced today. In many Indian traditions, the idea that you're purifying yourself by fire, not by water, but by fire. So you're building fires all around you. I think usually it's four fires, and then you go into the middle and you're sweating out or smoking out or whatever, you know, impurities, defilements by the power of this fire. So the Buddha was clearly advocating against those, saying that's useless. That's not really going to do the job. Of course, it depends really what you attach to it, you know, and then in terms of maybe my internal practices that you associate with it, it might actually help in terms of generating the energy, but it's not actually the ritual itself that does it, you know, it's an internal practice of kind of letting go. And I think we can extend that in this idea, you know, once you have this, remember, this is depending on this deep insight into the true nature of things and how the mind actually works, you know, then you realize you cannot bring this realization about through any kind of form of ritualized practices. So it's not just, you know, traditional purification rituals of religious traditions, but it's also like the way that we can hold on to, well, that would be still in the same area, isn't it? I'm not saying like you're going to have to burn three sticks of incense if you meditate, otherwise it's not going to work. But even maybe the way that we can hold on to particular kind of meditation practices, a particular kind of system, you're going to have to practice this kind of system, or you're going to have to attend, whether to attend to the breath at the nose or the belly. And, you know, only one of the techniques is going to work. I mean, I think if you've got a really taste of what reality is about, then you realize it doesn't depend on where you observe your breath. It doesn't even depend on observing your breath, actually, or whether you have actually that realization or not. It just doesn't make sense anymore. And the thing is, of course, behind it is because you see that directly from your own experience. So there's no argument about it. Other people might argue about it, but that doesn't concern you anymore because you have seen, you know. And interesting, I should add, there's another prerequisite that is actually mentioned again and again in the sutta, which is it's observance of the first four precepts, the moral precepts. So a certain level of ethical purity or ethical standards that you live to. And that's interesting. You could, of course, just say, well, that's some modern day, and not only modern day, of course, at the time of the Buddha, or other spiritual teachers would have dismissed that and said it was nothing to do with it. Something maybe that the Buddha added on because he wanted to make sure people behave properly or something like that. No, you always get it. But it's interesting. The Buddha was very clear about that. And that's in line with what I said earlier today. You know, when we look for a teacher, how to judge a teacher is, again, something which the Buddha was specific about. You can use that as a criteria. No, realizing for yourself that you're not necessarily capable of really ascertain with certainty, like the state of purity or advancement of another person just by using your intuition. I don't know what you see. He said, well, you can use that as a standard. You know, just observe somebody who is a teacher or whatever, somebody that you might feel inclined or wonder whether you should give them some authority, spiritual authority or whatnot in your life, whether to take them seriously in their advice. Just observe their behavior. And if they are not capable or willing to actually follow a moral conduct that is in line with the first four training precepts that the Buddha formulated, then he certainly, for one, said, I wouldn't trust them. They can't be that far. There's a few things that are not actually right in place. Because according to his judgment, for what we have with the suttas, it was certainly very clear. Without that, you're not going to get there. It doesn't mean that you can't have good meditation, good concentration, or even insights. But it's just, this is not gonna, it won't go deep enough to the roots of one's attachments, you know, the forces that hold us to the Vila Samsara, to actually loosen them to the stage that you can really say you've given up those three fetters. So that's actually an interesting thing also in terms of our contemplation. You know, you might see, because often, traditionally, how Buddhism came to the West, at least, often, you know, the first thing we're interested in, the wisdom teachings, the essence, you know, and then maybe the spiritual techniques to try to really get to the core of it, and as quick as possible, because in the modern world we tend to be trained in impatience, instant gratification, and so we also, if we can, then we also like to have instant enlightenment, of course. And I remember seeing this is still around. You'll find it advertised on the internet or things like enlightenment intensive weekend course. $10,000, and obviously it must sell, you know, otherwise it wouldn't be there. People go for that, and you know, say, well, it's expensive, so it must be good, and it's enlightenment intensive, it's just for me because I'm serious, you know, and then I'll do this weekend course, and then, you know, I'm crash through all the obstacles. I would side with the Buddha and rather warn against it. because you need really, if you look at the way, like in Theravada Buddhism, Pali Buddhism is explained, there are people like that who get a crash course from the Buddha and they break through in very short time. But the thing is that usually they have had a lot of preparation before. Now that's in our tradition, we call the building up of paramis, of perfections and of inner qualities that prepare your tools for really going deeper. You know? Those four precepts are really about building a parami. It's about that. You know? This quality is about developing wholesome mental qualities. They are about restraint, the ability of restraint. Remember I said, mindfulness without the capacity of restraint is weak, you know, because it doesn't give you the ability to actually stay the course of an impulse, say for just quickly satisfying your desire for pleasure or something. And if you can't do that, then it's very difficult to really examine it and look deeper into it. You know? Things like building up samadhi, that's an internal power, of course. Now, all those different qualities, they give your vehicle weight. So when it comes down the road towards perfection, if it's got more weight, it's got more momentum, isn't it? It can crush through more obstacles and barriers. If you're just traveling on a bicycle, then you don't want to dare driving through the same fences because you might hurt yourself. And that's what happens, of course, and what can happen on those intensive crash courses. It's like if you haven't got the vehicle for it, an electrical tool or whatever, and you put too much power into it, it's just gonna burn its fuses, and it's gonna go kaput. And it does actually happen to people on intensive courses as well. So this is an advertisement again for, you know, patience, and so gradual build up the kind of momentum through developing positive, wholesome resources. And then that gives us a basis to actually also in our meditation to go deeper. So that's something you can look at in many different angles, however, you see that this actually morality, practicing the precepts, from the original, I would say it's of course simplified, but for many people might have dismissed it. And actually it's not just a modern phenomenon, of course, even the Buddha had to contend with those kind of views. You say, oh, that's just extra, you do a bit of sila, a bit of morality on the side. But the real practice is, the Vipassana intensive or the Samatha, the jhana course, or things like that. But actually, without this, the power of the sila, then actually these tools of just attention and, Samatha and Vipassana and mindfulness might really just scratch at the surface. No, it's often this digging deeper into working with the precepts of morality, which actually make you have in your daily life, have to make you stop and consider what you're doing and why. Actually, they bring you deeper to actually the roots of your attachments, because it's the deeper roots of your attachments which will prevent you from actually following the precepts. And you say, well, the Buddha said, shouldn't do this, but I think in this situation, I can cut a corner, doesn't really quite apply. Where is that coming from? No. And that's the moment where really also to use, of course, these precepts to then use your mindfulness, use your attention to actually really look at that and be willing to look at that and dig deeper. Well, that's the way you get actually more to the roots. And if you really go to the roots and you could dig them out, it means you've got actually an impeccable morality. It does make a tremendous difference to the nature of your mind, the quality of your mind. And then if you take that vehicle into samadhi practice, well, it's a different story. No. You're not on a bicycle anymore. You might be driving a Ferrari. And so that you can go places with that. So those two prerequisites, and then maybe it might happen. And there you go. That's difficult for sometimes to know, isn't it? Because you might have had experiences and then we can get confused about it. And you say, well, yeah, well, I had this. It's not that uncommon. No, I had this experience of non-self. I saw the Dhamma. I saw through personality view. I realized I don't have any doubts. That's very clear. And yeah, it makes sense. Sila Bhatta Paramasa, that doesn't. So am I now Sotapanna? We wonder. And maybe we are, or maybe we are not. was this now deep enough or was it not? Because we don't, then that's of course where if you're in doubt, you're looking for the authorities who can really tell us. And some authority might tell you yes, another authority might tell you no, and then you're still again in the. But so maybe, of course, there are people that can tell us, and maybe Sotapanna is not actually that profound as we might sometimes think, because sometimes we put these things on a pedestal, and it must be something. This is the first stage of enlightenment. It can't be me, because I'm still doing so much nonsense. But two things. First of all, I said that before, and then I would just advise not to be too concerned about it. In line with what Ajahn Chah said, don't be too concerned about where you are, because that's again buying into personality view and all the worry about that. Rather, I think it's more useful to use this list, not as a scale, as a gauge to find out where am I on the map and worry about that, but just as a general kind of illustration about how this works and what the process is and which direction it goes. So for general orientation, then you're not too worried about it. It's like, well, maybe I am sort of panel. Maybe I'm not, but in the end, who cares? I know that there's still a lot of defilement there. So I got work to do. And that's an important thing to know. So don't get too hooked up about that, finding out or getting excited. Also, maybe I'm a Sotapanna, Wow, I'm going to tell, my friend about that. Why? I went through this routine. I might be a Sotapanna. Isn't that great? You see the danger about that, isn't it? It might even lead to complacency, isn't it? It's sometimes better not to know. The other thing is, yes, is to pick up that thread again is to say, yeah, maybe it's actually, I don't really know, no, and I don't mind, no. So to just sort of bring that across, but maybe it is not as advanced or as distant as we think, because, and that's an interesting aspect of this list, the Buddha was just saying, for entering the stream, it's really just about those first three fetters. And that's pretty clear. And depending on really exactly what it means, when you look at it, they are fairly, you know, if you've really seen, you know, if you had an experience with the sense of self drops, yeah, those first three fetters, they really start to become unstable, isn't it? Why, you know, they are not, they don't have that, they shouldn't have that much hold over you anymore. But the thing is, there are still seven left. And those seven fetters, they could have been, but they don't need to have been scratched at all in order to qualify as a sotapanna. Means like sensual craving, for example, which is the next one, the fourth one, and the fifth one, which is animosity or hostility, they could still be there full blown. No, and that can be part of that confusing, isn't it? Because that's certainly wherever we are, whether it's whatever, you know, our experience qualifies at, because we just shouldn't worry too much about it. But certainly it's not that uncommon that people have this insight, or you might call it breakthrough experiences, where really suddenly something opens and you have a very, very different way of experiencing reality. And that is really somewhat transformative. You've seen something. And it is very faith inspiring, because suddenly you see a possibility and say, wow, this is what it's all about, you know, what the Buddha is talking about. I wouldn't have thought this possible. So I don't know what kind of experiences you have had, but there are quite a few people who have those experiences. But then you have this amazing kind of spiritual experience, say mystical experience, whatever. But then we find actually we are not as transformed by that as we would have liked to be, or as we would have expected. And we might find ourselves again just doing all kinds of nonsense, getting ourselves in all kinds of trouble, suffering a lot, creating suffering for ourselves and for other people. And then we might, of course, start to get confused and doubt also our experiences. You know, in the first moment, as it happens, we get enthusiastic and say, well, this is it, you know, I'm arriving. This is, wow, I didn't think it was that, would go that quick, you know, things are opening up. And then it becomes a memory, because it's just an experience. You know, it's a window that opens, and it's still bound in time. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It might have been beautiful, but then it becomes a memory. And then you find yourself back in your ordinary life and in your ordinary mind, and you don't feel that transformed. Now, if you look at this list that the Buddha gives there as a model, then he says, well, yes, it's supposed to be like that. Because one thing is having this kind of breakthrough experience. Another thing is a gradual process of the purification of the heart, of the mind, to make yourself actually able to abide in that realization. You know? And again, it can be quite confusing. Why would it be that way? It's with many things, it's like that, isn't it? If you had a moment where you really let go of anger, you've really seen through it, and you think, well, I've done that one, tick the box, I've done anger. And then 2 weeks later, you find yourself getting terribly upset about something ridiculous and say, wow, I thought I'd seen through anger, and here I am again. Well, there you go. That's the force of habit. No, that's the force of habit. And the Buddha is talking about in terms of karma. No, that's the force of karma. No, that's built up for a long, long time. And that just keeps pushing into the same directions, you know, the direction of habit. And so remember, the Buddha was saying that sometimes if you have built up the parami, we can cut through a few things quite suddenly and profoundly and definitely. And but a lot of those things, there's a combination, there's a long momentum usually that builds up to those moments of breakthroughs. And often then afterwards, there's also a long time of actually then trying to get used to that new perspective and integrating that perspective, this new kind of way of experiencing, into your life. Or the other way around, integrating your life into that new way of experiencing then. And that can be also quite confusing and increases suffering, because some of your views and values might have changed, motivations, things that motivated you before, they just disappeared. But maybe you haven't yet found new motivation, and also the people around you haven't changed, you know, your friends, your family, and the way they look at you. It's not only your habits, nor also the way that people are used to see you. They haven't changed either. And then you're just going to somehow have to find ways of dealing with that, no? With other people's expectation. That can also be very difficult. The Buddha always had this on his plan, that this understanding that we can have this realization, but it's hardly ever complete. And it doesn't mean it has actually purified your whole kind of being. And that kind of awakening experience is not the end of the path. Like Ajahn Chah was saying, you know, if you've got this breakthrough experience, that's not the end of the path, that's the beginning of the path. Because that's when you've seen what is possible. And then comes the big frustration because you can't live it. No? The Buddha describes that even in the suttas with images. It's like if you walk through the desert and you arrive at the oasis, you're dying of thirst, and you see the water. You see the well with the water, but you can't reach it yet. No? You see what's possible. You know there's the water. You know your thirst is going to be quenched, but you can't get at the water yet. No, it's a bit like that kind of experience. In some ways, it can intensify actually your suffering, because now you really know how stupid you are, and you haven't got any justification. You know, you're done with just justifying it, or just everybody does the same, because you have seen that something different is possible, but you can't live it. Very frustrating, very painful. And in fact, if you're really smart, if you're really onto it, if you've got spiritual fire, then that is, of course, an extra motivation to really intensify the practice. Now, that's what Ajahn Chah certainly reported from his own spiritual development. The next stage, which is mentioned in the suttas, the Buddha calls it is Sakkaya Dagan, I think. And that's, we don't need to concern ourselves with the details precisely of what it means, but though it's got a specific name, the stage for it, the way it describes it is just somebody who has actually lessened the craving for sensuality and the opposite, the aversion, the hostility, negativity, to a significant amount. But it's not even specified, you know, exactly what's the point, how much do you have it reduced, or, you know, it's just said as a general term. At some point, you know, and this is actually through ongoing practice of sweating out your karma, your habits of going for sensuality, because you know better, but the train is still going there, and you just keep practicing what Ajahn Chah said, patient endurance, no? Then at some point, well, supposedly you qualify as, you know, what he called a once returner. So like that, it means there's not that much more left. Still enough to do, but there's a lot letting go of. But still, it hasn't been given up completely. Once sensual craving and negativity, hostility, aversion has been given up completely, that fetter has gone completely. So that means the first five, the lower fetters are gone. That's the third stage. That's called an anagami, called a non-returner. And that just makes sense if you say, like, non-returner means it would be somebody who, when at the dissolution of the body, when the body dies, they will never be able to be born in the sensory realm that we know through our five senses again. And it's obvious because they're not interested in any of that anymore. It doesn't mean also that they have aversion towards it, something, but they're just not, that's not what they motivate, what they're motivated by it anymore. So that is pretty cooled out, nibbana, you know, which means cooling, actually cooling of the mind. You know, there's not that much that ruffles a mind like that anymore. Because anything on the sensual level, they've actually done with that. This the whole kind of this push and pull of believing in the desire for or the aversion against doesn't have a hold over their mind anymore. And of course, we can speculate in the different views, maybe even about it. Does it mean this is completely gone, or does it mean it just doesn't stick in your mind anymore? Again, maybe we can concern ourselves about that when we arrive there. So before that, it's speculation. So maybe it's not all that important. But you see, I think the most important point is not that it's completely disappeared, But it is that your mind, your heart, your awareness has become so strong and so spacious that you're not fooled by any of that. I'm taking my cue there from an external authority, again, Ajahn Tate, this famous Thai monk who is also supposed to be an arahant, so not just a non-returner, but somebody who completed the path. And he reported to have said once, he says that many people, they believe that arahants, or completely freed people, are very far away, very far removed from their defilements, you know, like greed, hatred, delusion, or all the variations on it that niggle in our mind and drive us. And he said, not so. He said, even an arahant, a completely free person, is very close to their defilements, right? But they completely understand the defilements, so they're not fooled by them. So they don't follow them. They just know, well, this is a defilement, so I'm not going to follow that because the mind is completely clear about that. That is like in the suttas, where several times you see like where the Buddha, even after his awakening, is still visited by Mara. Remember, Mara, the personification of evil, of delusion, of attachment, of anything bad. No, so Mara still comes because Mara is a very powerful figure in the Buddhist mythology. It's like it's actually a Brahma god. Now you can see it in this way. It's just he's concerned because he rules over this realm. He doesn't want people to escape from it. You know, he rules over some samsara, so he wants to keep people in samsara because, you know, that's what he's got power over. So he keeps visiting the Buddha, trying to tempt him. No, like Jesus was tempted in the desert by the devil, no? In various kind of insidious ways, you know, trying to tempt him into some kind of defilement. And what does the Buddha? He doesn't fight Mara or something. He just turns around, looks at him and says, I know you, Mara. I know you. I know who you are. And then Mara gets very dejected. It's quite amusing, really, like how it's, you know, described in the sutras. He said, oh, you know, he's seen me. So, and then he disappears. No? And that reminds me of this, what Ajahn Tate was saying. It's not that desire might not come up, something, you know, but it's absolutely clear you're not going to believe the message. You know, it's that kind of state of purity. You know? So if the desire is innocuous or wholesome, you might decide to follow it if it's okay. You know, like arahants, somebody was asking about how does an arahant live? Now, I'm not an arahant, but from what I understand, they still have preferences. You know? And you can see that with lives. Arahants, always use the example because of the Thai tradition. Of course, we sometimes get Thai monks. And if you've got Thai supporters from lay supporters come actually here to the monastery. If you've got Thai monks visiting, they're not necessarily always arahants, of course. But even if they were, also our Thai supporters, they know that usually they don't really like muesli with bananas and dates and nuts and, you know, birka muesli like we have in Switzerland. They like, I don't know, these awful things. They like to have their rice soup with chili peppers and, you know, maybe even some, you know, dead chicken floating in there and things like that. That's a cultural conditioning. That doesn't need to go in order for you to be a free person. But the difference is, of course, if you're an arahant and say you come from Thailand and there is no Thai supporter here serving your chili for breakfast and it's going to be birka muesli, you're not going to make a problem out of it, right? That's the difference. You're not going to throw a tantrum if your toast is burned. But it doesn't mean that you don't have preferences. And that's like what Ajahn Tate was talking about, like even, you know, quite bold, but I take his word for him. You're certainly, you know, if anybody he would know, certainly not me. So he said, well, you're quite close to defilements, but you know them, you see them. I know you, Mara. So, and then only at the last stage, you know, when we talk about arahant, arahant is this Pali word for somebody who's completely free, has given up the whole lot of the fetters, all 10 of them. So remember, there are still 5 left, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4, we had 5. And so because number 6 and number 7, it's still craving, raga, but not for sensuality. Instead, it's this craving for fine material or non-material existence. No, so that gets pretty refined for most of us, I think. I don't know whether you've got any experience with that. That's certainly beyond me. But that's in the suttas, in the Pali suttas, there's very often kind of appears also mentioning reference to beings who live in more refined fine material or even non-material, so purely mental kind of realms of existence. So those would be realms of existence that we cannot experience through our physical senses because they do not correspond to what we know as physical reality. But supposedly, if you've got very good samadhi, then in the deeper stages of samadhi, you can cultivate psychic powers to actually connect with those realms. And occasionally, certainly in Thailand, there are monks who have that reputation, but in the West, it's rather rare. But who knows? I can't speak from personal experience there, but I've got faith in that. So that is still there. That's why, like a non-returner, you still got that. They are assured for never being reborn in the world that we know through other five physical senses. But they still got some form of craving or desire for some form of existence. So they'll be re-manifest in one of those more refined realms of existence where they would hopefully continue their practice. If you've gone that far in the practice, then I think usually you're pretty much assured that you are actually on the trajectory, so you're not going to get complacent. You just have this little detour, which can take quite a long time to do with those realms of existence. It is explained in the suttas, if you take samatha meditation to the most refined forms where your experience is really most pared down to simplicity and the mind just becomes very, very still, very, very refined. If you want to come out of the deepest kind of forms of these meditations, that is almost kind of equivalent as having a breakthrough inside because of the different mode of experience, the world basically completely disappearing. So you get a different appreciation about what the world of the senses actually is and how limited it actually is. But if you still hold on to this with some identification, well, then of course there's still some attachment left, and that is what makes you an anagami rather than an arahant, because you haven't yet let go of that experience itself. There's still some identification left, and so therefore the last three fetters, which I hadn't mentioned yet, which then also only the arahant lets go, have to do with that. They are mana, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance, of course, because that's the underlying fuel of all our attachments, our fetters. You can only have given up ignorance completely once you've completed the job. So that's by definition. And it's interesting, if you look at mana and restlessness, it's basically, mana refers to conceit. When the Buddha talks about conceit, he doesn't mean necessarily conceit in the narrow sense, like we talk about arrogance, like I'm better than you. He counts all the variations as forms of conceit, like if I consider myself as being better, being worse, or even as equal, because all of that have to do with self-view, isn't it? They have to do with some reference to me and some concern about how do I compare to others, And so because at this stage, even like this anagami has gone very far, hasn't completely given up yet, there's still a subtle form, mind you, that's probably pretty subtle form, but of self-concern. Because they haven't quite completely let go of identification yet. And with that, of course, also comes still a remnant, a very subtle form of restlessness, because there's still something to do, something that's going to push your mind, because the mind hasn't actually yet completely settled. There's a very amusing story in the Anguttara Nikaya about that. It illustrates some of the subtle humor as well of the Pali Canon, which two of the most advanced disciples, the most famous disciples of the Buddha, his cousin Anuruddha and Sariputta, his right-hand man. Sariputta at the time was actually completely liberated. Anuruddha wasn't. But Anuruddha was famous and known for having tremendous psychic powers. And his particular ability was the divine eye, so-called divine eye, with which you could see, as describes something like an overview of the 10,000 world systems. So he could see things in the distance, as it were, it's something like third eye, something like that. But he wasn't completely liberated yet. But he was obviously a tremendous gifted meditator, very good samadhi and much respected in the Sangha. He also was a cousin of the Buddha. He meets with Sariputta. He searches out Sariputta and he asks him, your good friend Sariputta, can you help me? I've got this problem. He's saying something like, my problem is here I am. I'm striving with unrelenting energy and effort. You know, I'm even famous for that. I'm striving with this unrelenting effort. And my mind, I have developed my mind to the ability of, you know, overseeing the 10,000 fold world system, you know, like nobody else can do except for the Buddha, actually. And yet still, I'm not freed from suffering. What am I doing wrong? It's quite interesting because it's the same thing that we are doing, only with usually a bit more mundane problems, isn't it? We usually, I guess we're not quite as far down the path, but it's the same kind of thing. You know, if you're not quite there where you want to be, so what am I doing wrong? Give me the trick. And Sariputta obliges and answers in a way that could appear, it might not actually be intended like that, but it could appear certainly to a modern reader like a bit cheeky, by replying, telling, well, dear friend Anuruddha, actually, your unrelenting effort is just an expression of your restlessness. Take that. You're concerned about your capability of overseeing the 10,000-fold world system. That's just your conceit. Remember, those are two of the last shackles, conceit and restlessness, you know, that he points out there for him. And your complaint about that you still haven't realized the deathless, you know, Nibbana, that's just your worry and doubt. So this doesn't serve you very well at all, Anuruddha. You should abandon your concern with that and instead turn your mind towards the deathless element. Now we might ask, well, what's the deathless element? But Anuruddha knew what he was talking about. So basically, he's turning his mind away from these concerns. Now, here's my interpretation, which, mind you, this is just from my very limited understanding. But the way I interpret that is, well, you can see what the Buddha is, not the Buddha, Sariputta is pointing out here. He's all kind of concerned. But this is still, even if it's on a very refined level, it's still concerned with self-view and with the content of experience. No, even it's not a chocolate cake in his case, it's a 10,000-fold world system. It's very spiritually elevated, but it's still out there. You know? And then Sariputta says, you should turn your mind away from those concerns and turn it towards the deathless element. Now, what's the deathless? The way to the deathless is mindfulness, is awareness itself. Now, my first approximation is it's something to do with turning awareness towards itself. What is it actually, you know, that is experiencing this? And Anuruddha, obviously, being that far with his practice, he doesn't get upset. His conceit is not that strong, you know, to say that, oh, sorry, Putta, you know, I feel rather hurt about what he's saying, you know, you're telling me. No, he says, thank you. No, that's very good advice. And he does what Sariputta tells him. And supposedly, not long afterwards, he got completely liberated and freed from suffering. You know, that's an interesting. If you read the suttas, it can be very difficult reading because there's a lot of repetition in there. It's this natural for oral traditions. But every now and then you get these gems of things that stick out, which only appear once and are very quite unique kind of stories. And they're often quite nice. Also showing you really kind of personalities, you know, the disciples of the Buddha. You know, remember these teachings, they're 2,500 years old. So it's very, very old stories. Okay. So that's my usual spiel for the 10 fetters. If this would be a longer retreat, then I should get back down to earth. And I said, we should probably work more with a different list, which are the 5 hindrances. I haven't even talked about yet. No, I won't on this retreat anymore. But it's interesting to have this kind of outlook, no, about what might be ahead. And even though, see, again, like instead of instant enlightenment, which is very popular these days and might be an option for a few people and happened to a few people at the Buddha's time, they just listened to the Buddha's teaching and bingo, that was it. It's sometimes, you know, inspiring, depending how you look at it, inspiring or frustratingly easy. If you read it in the book, they are awakened within 3 pages. But, you know, remember, those are usually people that have already a tremendous history, possibly, of building up spiritual momentum. And so the Buddha often really gives a long view, isn't it? No. Like usually it said, like with the first stage of stream entry, said, well, you know, this is great, you know, because you're on the safe side. Once you enter the stream of Dhamma, you can't really turn back. That's what it says. And it also makes sense in a certain way, because you can if you have this very strong experience, you might feel it sometimes, you doubt it because you notice you're still doing all kinds of nonsense. But on another hand, you can't forget that. You can't deny what you have seen. That makes a very strong impression on the mind. So you might actually doodle around, do a lot of extra detours, but somehow that's the understanding behind it. You come back to that insight. It has changed something in the momentum of your movement, but according to the Buddha, through lifetimes. No, it's not about next week or, you know, after another couple of retreats. Of course, those things might speed up, and who knows how much parami you have built up and what's in store for you. But the only thing that the Buddha promises, apparently, is that maximum another 7 lifetimes. So depends, you know, how you feel about life, whether at the moment you're just on the bhavatana side, but, you know, more bliss, or on the vibhavatana, or want to get out of this. You might just think, well, 7 more lifetimes of increasing bliss sounds not bad. Or you think, oh my God, 7 times more going through this, really? So then you've got some urgency going, isn't it? You better speed up to become at least a non-returner, isn't it? Or, you know, don't want to come back to this. So just see in your own mind how you feel about that. But that's the perspective of the Buddha. You know, the Buddha talks about lifetimes. This might take time, but there's nothing more important or better to do anyway. So you just keep investing, and it just takes the time that it takes. An oak tree takes a long time to grow, but you can't speed it up. And if you do speed it up, it's going to be weak. How could I know if I attained stream entry in a former life? If yes, I could relax because it's just 6 lives left. Yes, I've contemplated those things too. And who knows, no, how literally really to take these things in the suttas. I don't know. I've asked these questions also to other people, and I've got interesting different kinds of answers. But I think mostly for me, at least, I've got my faith or confidence is say, like, more like what they indicate in terms of an orientation in how it works. Whether that's exactly 7 lifetimes or not sounds a little bit deterministic, but maybe it's true. But it's just what basically the message is, there's a change. There's a lot of things that has been cut off, and there's only one direction to go. And it kind of makes sense to me, to my rational mind. And if you just want to relax, who knows? But depends. Do you really want to do another 6? Maybe you do. If you're feeling groovy, then maybe. No, that's the interesting thing with Buddhism, the thing about rebirth, depending how you feel about life, it can feel, you know, sometimes like I've been around like this for eons, and there might be more. And again and again, gives you an extra urgency to want to get out. But on the other hand, if you're still attached to life, it's also reassuring to think, well, you know, maybe death is not the end of it. I've got to get another chance, you know. Like the Dalai Lama cheekily said in a seminar, together with a Christian monk, Father Lawrence Freeman, you know, from a Christian meditation tradition. And they were kind of talking, they were obviously very friendly with each other, but then at some point the Dalai Lama, who doesn't mind also pointing out differences and pulling other people's legs, he was kind of turning around to Father Freeman and said, well, you guys, you know, that's the thing is, man, you're really gonna have to work hard, because if you get it wrong, you're gonna go to hell, isn't it? Whereas we Buddhists, you know, we've got it easy because we always get another chance. If you don't get it right this time, well, we just come back and just try a bit more next time, you know. So it depends how you feel about life, isn't it? It can make you lazy, or it can make you really wince and intensify your effort, isn't it? It's just, it really reflects back of how your own mind really works, whether you are a bhava type or a vibhava type. Who did say that this existence is wasted if you don't even reach stream entry in this life? I don't know who said that, but I think he or she got it wrong. I don't agree. None of your effort is wasted. That's why I don't agree with the statement, because no effort is wasted. Any positive karma that you create goes onto your so-called karmic bank account. No, it does count in the future. It does make a contribution. And that, I think, is what's the statement about, if you reach this stage of stream entry, it's just you cannot really fall back. So it only goes in one direction. How long exactly it's going to take? Well, you know, who knows? But of course, in future lives, it's bit uncertain, you know, exactly how it manifests, because all kind of karma from the past can ripen. But what you have realized this time, and the effort you have made this time, in some way or another, will come into account. So it will help you on the path. So sooner or later, it will manifest in some way or another. And it is that what in the scriptures, like when the Buddha has this, you know, somebody coming, listening, asking the Buddha a question, listening, the Buddha telling to them, and they get it straight away. No, it has to do, of course, with the momentum they have built up in the past. So it could be sometimes people that you see that take to meditation. And any of you have heard about Ruth Dennison? I heard a story about Ruth Dennison once. So Ruth Dennison was one of the disciples of Uba Khin. Uba Khin was a Burmese meditation teacher who authorized 5 disciples to become teachers themselves. The most famous one of those is Goyenkaji. No? So he was Goyenka, the whole Goyenka Vipassana system came out of that. Another one was Mother Sayama, I think it was her name. It's a kind of also Indian, similar. And then there were 3 Westerners, John Coleman, Ruth Dennison, and another one whose family name is Hart, I think. I've forgotten the first name. And I met John Coleman. And John Coleman told me the story how he was actually practicing with Uba Khin and his center in Burma. And there was another American, John Coleman was American, there was another American with him there, a psychologist practicing. And then at some point, he was married though. And so at some point his wife turned up. And she was a real pain in the neck because she came because she was worried about her husband getting into this meditation thing. And he was thinking about maybe becoming a monk and all that. And she thought she might lose her husband. So she came and was nosing around and causing trouble. And then Uba Khin, the teacher, finally she got on his nerves and said, well, if you want to stay here, you're going to also have to practice. You're going to have to do the same as your husband does and John does, and there might have been a few others, you know, just go into the retreat mode and do that. And I said, okay, if that's what needed, then I'll do that. And so she went to have her first meditation session with Uba Khin. And according to John Coleman, Uba Khin explained meditation to her, and she went straight into the jhanas, first meditation. And I'm saying, wow, how did that happen? Certainly not what happened to me. And that happened to be Ruth Dennison. So the funny thing about the story is, of course, well, jhanas were actually not the point what actually Uba Khin was even teaching. And it's not what Ruth Dennison ended up emphasizing. But the first meditation, she was into the jhanas, and she became the meditation teacher and divorced her husband. So it went the other way around. No, so her husband, on the other hand, apparently never really got the point. He was a very intellectual type. He was just thinking about the whole kind of thing and trying to analyze and understand and never got anywhere. And Ruth Dennison became a famous meditation teacher. One doesn't know, but of course, from a traditional Buddhist point of view, would say, well, maybe this was an instance where, for example, maybe even past life, karma, whatever, just ripened at that moment and just burst through. So maybe the whole life up to there, it didn't even manifest at all. No, it was kind of dormant, but it already needed to be kindled by this meeting with an actually very advanced teacher that suddenly something awakened, no? And then comes to fruition. No? And yeah, maybe it's a bit like that. No? How often, of course, our spiritual life kind of is very rarely kind of a smooth advancement. No? Strange things happen, something. You know, think about yourself or people that you know, how they came to the teaching, how they responded. You know, they suddenly things seem to fit. You don't know where this is coming from. You know?